Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Boston Sean C. When I first got sober in 2007, every time I turned around, there was Boston Sean. So I'm going to say that he was a big part of my early sobriety. A lot of things have happened. He is now a Cobb County resident, a member of the Leland Group out in Cobb County. He's going to tell you more about that, and welcome.
Oh, wow. Hey, everybody. My name is Sean. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. Thank you, Tim, for asking me, even though I don't mean it just yet. I usually don't dress like this. I feel like a defendant again, and you know, I'm guilty, Your Honor, but with an excuse this time. Anyway, every time I do this, I just get nervous. I love the name NABA, Northside Alcoholics Benevolent Association. Benevolent. That's what happened to me. I didn't mean for that to happen. But it means kindness and caring for others. And that's part of the getting sober. It's part of living sober. And somehow I do that today. I don't know why. But anyway, I am from Boston, a tiny little country up north called New England. I walked into a play at against Sam's last week, and I was buying some. I said, do you have any footballs without any air in them? But my sponsor told me a long time ago. I told my story for the first time. It was in Easter Sunday in 2000. And he told me, and he was a good old boy from South Georgia. His name is Wes. And it's two syllables, way-ass. Three if you're good, he said. And two people that normally wouldn't mix, you know. And I couldn't understand him. He couldn't understand me, but somehow. And he told me, he goes, your story was okay, but really, you got to explain. If you speak in the South, you got to explain what a packy is. And packy is a package store. It's short for package store, liquor store, whatever. We had the blue laws in Massachusetts, so if you got drunk on Sundays, you had to make a packy run, and a New Hampshire packy run at that. And the other thing he told me, if you tell your story, explain what party is, P-A-R-T-Y. He goes, because I thought you had, like, stomach problems. You partied a lot, dude. It's like, oh, okay, sorry. Anyway, my sobriety date is July 26, 1999. My home group is Leland. It's in Mableton. My home group was Easy 123 in Duluth for a long time. And last year I was fortunate enough. We got married and I moved over to Cobb County. And so I had to find another home group. And it was strange. It was different. And I also go to Sons of Serenity on Monday nights a lot, too. And my sponsor back at the old place was Mike S. And so I got a new sponsor, Mike K, and I just changed my initials. That's all I did. But anyway, I have a sponsor. When I first came in at Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what a sponsor was. I was so naive. I didn't know what chips were. I didn't know what a sponsor was. And I grew up, my uncle was a race driver, so I knew all about sponsorship on race cars. And I really thought that to get a sponsor, you had to go out and solicit businesses, and maybe they would put up some money and sponsor. I really thought that. I was that naive. What it was like is, I like to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And what it was like, basically, I grew up in a nice middle-class family. There was no drinking, no alcohol in the family. And I didn't start drinking until I was 23. Isn't that sad? I had drinks before, but drinking the way we drink. And that wasn't until my first drunk, I was 23 years old. It's just, I blew my whole college education. But what it was like was if You know, there's two questions in the book. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you may be alcoholic. And that's what happened to me. I drank enough that I couldn't stop drinking. And if you're new tonight, I'm speaking to you, because the message that I bring is one of hope. If you are stuck like I was, and you were just going from room to room, not going outside, just isolating as much as you can, knowing that there's no solution, well, there is one. And I didn't think there was. I thought I was so different that when I came in here, I didn't gel with you people. I didn't. Everyone was laughing. I wasn't laughing. And I saw everybody was, bathed. I wasn't bathed. I just had no interest in what you had. And yet, I wanted to get sober. And at the same time, I wasn't sure if I wanted to get sober. I was on the fence. And I came to my first meeting in 1989. And I was just to get my wife off my back. I was married back then, and I was just to, cool her. And then I came in a few other times just to save a job. But I knew when I came in at the beginning that I was going to go drink, because this was just to let the dust settle and so I could go back out and drink. And I had no intention on staying sober. But then it kept getting worse and worse and worse, and I found myself drinking at on the job. And I worked in an office, and I'd hide my booze in my briefcase. Back then you had to wear a suit and tie and briefcase. And I was proud of the fact that I could throw up and not hit my shoes. I was good, But I would always I'd have stashed everywhere. And during breaks I would go out and find my stash and drink. I even had this little door to the elevator shaft, and I would hide my booze in there somehow. And I could drink. And lunch I would drink, and I'd be late for lunch coming back. And then when it was 5 o'clock, it was on. And whether I made it to work the next day, it was a crapshoot. I had no idea. I wanted to, and I wanted to hide it from everybody. I didn't want anyone to know, but yet they knew. And I knew they knew. But I still tried to hide it. And I, as they say down the south, I was bad to drink. And I was. I just couldn't stop drinking. And the way I drank, I had my home base, my default drink was a screwdriver. I love vodka and orange juice. But it seemed like when I went to weddings, I'd have white Russians. When I'd fly on a plane, I'd have rum and coke. And I'd switch up, and sometimes I'd switch to wine. And when I was bouncing in and out in the early days, having no intention on staying sober, I'd get drunk and I'd pretend I'm telling my story. And one time I had a big bottle of white wine, and I memorized the preamble. The Alcoholics Anonymous was a fellowship of men and women. And then when it gets to the point where we are not allied with any sect denomination, that took like a three-quarters of a jug. Just to memorize all that. I don't know what that was all about, but I had no idea. And I was lonely. I was extremely lonely. I had plenty of people around me, but I wanted you all to go away. I wanted to go back to my apartment and hide. I felt safe when I was by myself alone with my bottle. And I didn't feel safe out here. I felt safe there, though, and I felt safe when I was drinking. When I opened that up, I would get excited. I would be excited before I even hit the packy. I'd just knowing I was getting a drink, that was good. That was really good. That was best. And I always liked that expression, half in the bag. Well, I was never half in the bag, except for the times, getting fully in the bag. It's kind of like passing a mile marker. You have to go buy it, but, it's like I wasn't going to stop there. My drinking was, when I first moved down here, I started getting sober in 1999, and it was scary. I didn't like it. I hated it. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated being a goody two-shoes. I hated all of that. But there was a meeting we went to. It was they even had a topic on it at Triangle one morning, and it was about this peacock. I don't know if you remember the peacock at the Atlanta Zoo, but they used to have this peacock, and it would walk around the zoo, and everyone could pet it. It was kind of like so people would, be attracted to the zoo, I guess. Well, this peacock would always end up in the with the orangutans and get its, get its, uh, you know, get beat up. You know, I'm trying to keep this clean. Unbeknownst to me, this was discreetly recorded. But, you know, I... But, you know, and the orangutan would always, I mean, they're just beat up on this peacock. And so they'd have to take the peacock, put it in sick bay, fix it up. But then they'd let it go loose again. And it would end up back in the cage again and get all over. And this kept happening. And we actually had a meeting about this. It was kind of like the modern day jaywalker. You know, it was like, you know, it just can't keep away from the orangutan cage. And so they had to actually lock this peacock up. And I could relate to that because that's what happened to me. If I was going to stop drinking, you had to lock me up. I wasn't going to do it on my own. And every time they let me go, every time I'd go to a detox unit or every time I'd come out of rehab, back again. You know, I'd try to hold off for as long as I could, but, oh, no, I was back again. And I couldn't stand it. And I remember one time my wife said to me, she goes, you know, if you keep drinking, I'm going to, you know, we're going to get divorced. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I guess we're going to get divorced. It's like that song, I'm going to miss you. You know, it's like, you know, and I said, well, I'm going to try to hold off as long as I can, but I know it's inevitable. I better start planning now because I'm not going to stop drinking. And alcohol made decisions for me, too. You know, I joined the union at my job just because I knew if I go to management, they can fire me, and they would. And so the union protected me for a long, long time. And it got to the point where even they were afraid to, you know, stick up for me because they knew they were putting their neck on the line for me. And I went to a lot of, I went to a lot of rehabs, detoxes throughout the 90s. And I wanted it, but I didn't. I couldn't imagine what it would be like not drinking. I just couldn't imagine. And so... When I got sober, there was another story about the first step. There was I was dating a girl down in Daytona Beach, and she was a hospice nurse. And one day I was down there visiting. It was a weekend, and I was visiting. She goes, "I'm sorry, it's a Saturday, but I got to go out and see this guy. He's 42 years old. He has cirrhosis of the liver, and he's dying. And so I got to go see him. But I'll be back after lunch." I go, "Okay." Well, she comes back and she's all crying. I see she had been crying, and she was all upset. And she was all worked up, and she was like, "Oh, shaking." I mean, there was something wrong. I thought maybe she got in a car accident or something. She goes, "This guy I talked to, he's 42 years old. He's dying of cirrhosis of the liver. And do you know what he did?" And I'm thinking to myself, he probably made himself a drink. She goes, "He went to the kitchen and made himself a drink." And I'm thinking, yeah, I thought so. And then she looks at me. She goes, "You're not even shocked at that." I said, "No, apparently you don't know about alcoholism. We can't stop even when we want to. Maybe he doesn't even want to. I don't know." But that was the way I drank. That was the way I drank because I could not stop. Even if it had come to that, I would have kept on drinking. I don't know why I got sober this time. I have no idea why I got sober. It was just a set of circumstances. The day I got sober, my last drink was at Hooters in Norcross. And I say that because I like to. I'm an idiot. No other reason. It just happened to be down the street, and I was too drunk to drive, so I said, well, I'll walk to there. Oh, there's a Hooters. I think I'll go in there. I still have the receipt from there, and the girl signed, "We hope you come back," and with a smiley face. I still have that. It's in my sobriety box. It's like a token. But I had no idea that was going to be my last drink. Had no idea. The next day, I was supposed to go to Ridgeview for rehab, and I walked over there, and you know, my master plan was to get a bottle of booze, you know, smooth them over for a little while in the access center, and then go back out and drink for the rest of the day, and then go back to work. Well, they kept me, and that was not in my plan. And they brought us there, you know, and I stayed there, and I was sober. I said, you know what? And I remember thinking, next time they get me into rehab, I'm going to be drunk because this is foolish. I can't believe I'm at rehab sober. This is stupid. I said, that was just a lack of planning, and I was mad. And I knew there was a packy down the street, and I was ready to take a chair and put it through the window. And I mean, I really wanted to. I said, "You just screwed up my day of drinking. I had this all planned." But they were going to keep me. And so I realized, you know what? I've been kind of wanting to get sober for a while now. And, you know, maybe this is the opportunity. I don't know. And that's when my higher power, I didn't know it at the time, but that's when my higher power said, all right, it's time. He had been inviting me to Alcoholics Anonymous for years, and I kept saying, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. And finally, this time, I don't know, I just decided to do what you told me to do. And the counselors started, you know, talking to me, and I met friends there, and they were doing sober things. We had a Serenity Garden, and we started building that. And I stayed there for 3 weeks. And when I left rehab, this time, instead of going back to the apartment, I went back to Easy 123, which was my home group, which is where Wes was. And old Wes. I call him old Wes. He's 14 years younger than me and bigger than me, but I call him old Wes. Anyway, he was there, and I walked up. Ready for the Boston accent? I parked the car, and I parked it right up front, and I walked up to the door, and I was going to go in. And I said, "Oh no, I can't." And so I walked back to the car, and I did that 4 times. Finally, I said to myself, "You know what? If I don't go in, I'm going to be drunk. I don't know when, I don't know where, but if I don't get a support group or something, if I don't need ask for help, I'm going to get drunk, and I don't want to." And for that one clear moment, I walked in, and there was a guy named Terry. He was an old-timer, and he had a... It was hot out. It was like 118 degrees or something like that outside, and he was this truck driver, and he had farmer jeans on, no shirt, and the hairiest back and chest, and he goes, "Give me a hug." And I'm thinking, we think not, you know? I'm like, oh. He goes, "Willing to go on any length." And I said, "Oh, Jesus. He goes, I hate you people. I hate it." And so I gave him a hug. And anyway, he sat me down. He goes, "Why don't you go in the meeting room? I'll get you a cup of coffee." I said, "All right." "Oh, I hate this." You know, and so I walked in, and who's there but Wes and his sponsor, Daryl. And Daryl was younger than me, too. And Daryl's from Kentucky. Wes is from someplace, South Georgia. And I can't understand either one of them. And Daryl goes, "Look at him. I think he's done." And I looked at him and I said, "What? Do I look like a steak to you?" Then I realized Daryl can kick my ass. So I started running. And I turned around and ran. And Daryl's like yelling at Wes, "Wes, go get him, go get him," like Wes is some sort of canine. And, you know, Wes goes, hey, Bubba, Bubba, you know, and he comes running after me. And he finally gets me before I reach the door. And he goes, "Hey, Bubba, has anyone ever talked to you about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "Well, I tried it, but I didn't really get too far with it." He goes, "Well, I'll take you through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Does anyone ever taught you about Georgia football?" I said, "Well, I know about it." He goes, "Well, I'll teach about that, too. They're both spiritual in nature. I don't care what you get first." So, from then on, whenever Wes would tell me something that I didn't agree with, I'd always wear a Tennessee hat or something. You know, did I upset you, Bubba? I said, "Yes, you did." I have a Georgia Tech hat at home, too. And, you know, but getting sober, I'm telling you, getting sober at first, it was, I hated it. And but yet I felt hope. I felt hope. And we started working the steps. And, you know, the first step, I really had done that at home. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew my thinking was unmanageable. I knew all of that. The only reason I was in AA was the second step, because I knew, you know, I can't do it on my own. I need help. And for now, you're going to have to be my help, because I believed in God, but... You know, Wes told me, "Don't worry about the God thing. He'll show up. As you do the steps, he's going to show up. But for now, let's do the rest of the steps." And okay. So, I went over to his house one night. And he says, "Bring a notebook with you." I said, "All right. We're going to do the third and fourth step." I said, "Really?" And he goes, "Yeah." And his wife made this lasagna. So, you know, he got my attention. And so I went over there and... he sent his wife and his daughter out to the Gwinnett Mall, and and the next thing you know, we're on our knees on a Friday night, holding hands, saying the third step prayer. I'm thinking this is a little odd, and it's like, well, I guess. And and then he started getting me onto the fourth step. He explained to me that the third step's only a decision. He goes, "Are you ready to do this fourth step?" I said, "Yeah, I am," and I really was. I couldn't believe it. I'm thinking, I can't believe what I'm saying. I said, "Because I'm not sure if I am, but I think I am. So let's do it. So he wrote down the columns, and he told me how to do a four-step. a few weeks later, he had me do my fifth step. And, you know, and I thought, I'm going to have this white light experience and everything. And that didn't happen. All it did was that it made me aware of certain things, certain defects of character. And I remember when I did my sixth step, it says to go home and think for an hour. And when I went home, I went home and, I fell asleep for an hour and a half. And I'm thinking, oh, God, I screwed up. I'm going to get drunk. I really thought that. And I thought, you know, I'm going to get drunk because they explained to me that the steps are kind of like the recipe for a cake. And if you know, and so I'm thinking, oh, my God, I just screwed up. I got the ingredients wrong or the amount, you know. And so I called him, and it was 2 in the morning. I said, Wes, I overslept. I didn't concentrate. It was an hour and a half. He couldn't stop laughing. He even woke up his wife to tell him. He goes, you know what this stupid Yankee did? You know, what a moron. He goes, call me in the morning. I thought, okay. And that's what it was like getting sober. It was like scary, isn't it? Because I knew I was going to screw up. I knew I wasn't fit for this. I was getting hope. And I was staying sober, and it had been a few months. You know, every time I see somebody get a 30-day chip, I'm thinking, that's 4 weekends. Because weekends, I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And, and here it was, you know, I was getting a day, and then I'd wake up, and I'd get another day. And I couldn't believe this. I mean, I really, this is weird. And in the obsession, one day I was at Triangle, and there was a guy. And he said about how the obsession had left him years ago. And I thought, you know what? I haven't thought of a drink. Oh, my God, it's got to be a month now. Maybe even longer. I don't know. And I remember leaving that meeting. I was 5 feet off the ground. I was just couldn't believe it. This thing's working. I can't believe it. And I called Wes. I said, Wes, this is working. He goes, yeah, I know. And he hung up. And so you know, I started working with him and... the weird thing is, you know, and I made amends. I made amends to my wife. I made amends to my parents. They didn't know what I was talking about. They were in full denial. They didn't know what I was talking about. My sister had no idea what I was talking about. She said, whatever, you know. But I did make amends to my wife, my first wife. And at first, it was a little scary because back then it was like, I did it at Stone Mountain. I didn't know where to find her. She was back in Massachusetts. And so I'm walking around Stone Mountain, and, you know, back then the cell phones were like mini speakers that hung on your shoulder or something, you know. Oh, you know. And so I'm talking to her, and I made amends. And at the end of that conversation, we were laughing. We were laughing. I couldn't believe it. And later on, you know, when my parents passed away, she was at the funerals, both funerals, and... when her dad passed away in 2009, I was asked to be a pallbearer. So, and that's all through the, you know, making amends. Anyway, I started doing the steps, and I started going through everything, and you know, the tenth step where you take inventory, and when you're wrong, promptly admitted it. Well, I didn't get the promptly right, but you know, I was willing somehow. Yeah. And I didn't get it. I didn't understand everything, and I found out that that's okay. Just keep trying the best, and that's what I did. I was doing it wrong, and it wasn't smooth. Believe me, you know, when I walk down the street today, if you've ever seen a NASCAR race, you see when they have the in-car cameras, and you see when they pan outside, you see the cars. They're side by side. They look smooth, and they're going, you know. But on the inside, you know, you got the tact, you know, everything's pegged, and you got the smoke and the brake light, you know, everything's going on, and that's how I go through life. And it's like, Jesus. And you know, the inside is just a mess, you know, but the outside I might cover it up a pretty good. And like right now. But you know, I don't know. I just, you know, and I don't know. That's how it seems like it goes. But what happened was, God showed up. I didn't mean for that to happen. I was just going to meetings, minding my own business, and God showed up. And it was the weirdest thing. And wasn't any big bright lightning. But again, I was walking around Stone Mountain, and I was on the other side of the mountain. And I didn't have my to-go cup filled with vodka. I was just by myself. I had some water, probably. And I realized, you know what? I'm on the other side of the mountain. I haven't thought of a drink all day. And here I am, free as a bird. I'm not even drinking. You know, I'm going. I went to a meeting this morning. I'm going to a meeting tonight. I am happy. It was the first time I felt joy in a long, long time, probably ever. And all the cars are coming this way, and I'm walking the other way, like Leave It to Beaver, Discover Stone Mountain or something, and you know, geeky looking, you know, and just doy. I felt joy, and so I called Wes. I said, Wes, not the thing to do, but Wes. I said, I'm feeling happy. He goes, but he told me a few things that I can't repeat here. But then he goes, really, seriously, Bubba, that's the business, that's the program working for you. He goes, God has touched your life. You're joyful. That's what it, you know. And I say, well, I hate it. I did. It was uncomfortable. And I didn't want to be that happy. I just didn't. It was just ridiculous. And but I was happy, you know. Is at the same time, it was something to get used to, because it was just unnerving. I hadn't experienced that kind of joy before. And so I kept doing things, and eventually he told me to sponsor people. And I wasn't a very good sponsor at first. I'm probably still not, but you know, but it was you know, I started doing service work. When I first got into Alcoholics Anonymous, he would have me clean the ashtrays, and I remember the first day he became my sponsor. He says, "Well, clean the ashtrays." I said, "Yeah, but Wes, I don't smoke." He goes, "Well, I don't care. It worked for me." And I couldn't argue with him. And it's like, well, if it were for you, okay, I'll clean the ashtrays. And he goes, take out the trash. And I couldn't figure out why this had anything to do with getting sober. But I did it because I wanted to change. I wanted something to change. And so what happened was I changed. And somehow my higher power showed up. And, you know, I was asked to describe my higher power at a meeting a few weeks ago. And I said, I really don't know. I just don't know. I just know it's something other than me. And, you know, it's like I had the Catholic God, you know, but he's gotten a lot older and more mellow in his age. And you know, he's nicer, you know. That's the only way I can describe it. I don't know. All I know is there's something out there, because I couldn't stay sober on my own. And my sponsor back in Boston, his name's Paul, and he used to always say, you know, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. And I've seen too many coincidences for there not to be a God. And, you know, it just happens that way. And let's see, in 2004, my mother had Alzheimer's, and she passed away in September. I was down in Daytona, and I got a call, and, you know, they said, you know, you got to come home. And so I was ready to just go right from Daytona. And so I called. I couldn't. My sponsor at the time was at the Bristol race. So I called Paul, my Boston sponsor. And I said, Paul, my mom died. And so I'm going to drive back to Gainesville. You know, I was living in Gainesville, Georgia at the time. I'm going to drive back to Gainesville and then fly out of Atlanta. He goes, no, go back to Daytona and sleep the night and wake up in the morning and call me. So when I woke up the next morning, there was a ticket, you know, for that later on that night in Atlanta. He had got me a ticket, and he goes, I'll meet you in Providence Airport at you know, such and such a time. So I flew into Providence that night, and where does he take me? He didn't take me home. He took me to a meeting, and all his hoodlum buddies are there, and it was and I felt safe, and I felt you know, and at no time during that time did I want to drink, which was really uncanny. Because this is the biggest thing. I always thought, if anything ever happened to my parents, I can't go through that kind of pain. I'll drink. And not only didn't I drink, I didn't even think of it. And halfway up, driving up back up to Gainesville, I called Wayus. And I said, Wayus, my mom passed away. And he goes, and he called me, instead of Bubba, he called me Sean. And he says, Sean, I want you to go up to Boston, and I want you to be of service to your dad and to your sister. I said, what? Wait a second. Let me. No, my mom passed away. He goes, no, and you didn't hear me either. You go up there and be of service. And so he called me Sean, so I kind of paid attention to it. And so I went up there, and I was of service. He had told me that, you know, my dad didn't have a program. He had never lost a wife. My sister had never lost a mother. But, you know, and I had never lost a mother, but I had a program, and they didn't. So I went up there, and I was asked to read stuff. I was asked to be a part in the funeral service, and it was unbelievable, and I stayed sober. And when I flew back to Atlanta after getting everything done, my dad dropped dead. He passed away like a few weeks later. Just dropped dead. And so I turned around and I called Wes, and he said, well, go up and do the same thing, be a service. All right. So I flew up and I did the best I could. And my sister and I were sitting in the funeral home. And, I put my arm around her, and I held her. And I said, I don't know what we're doing back here, but, you know, there's got to be a reason. And anyway, that afternoon, it was I was at CBS and getting the obituaries because we were famous. And we were in the paper. And anyway, I was getting the obituaries, and this lady's in front of me, and she had a kid, and she's holding up the line because of too many coupons. And no resentment. And but anyway, no, this baby, she's sitting right there, and I started playing with the baby. I started, hey, and I was waving, and she's all thrilled, and she's kicking her feet, and she's blowing bubbles, and just having a great time. And it dawned on me at that minute, you know, I'm not supposed to be this happy. I'm not supposed to be this joyful. I'm not supposed to be playing with this baby and having such a great time. I'm supposed to be miserable. I'm supposed to be down at O'Flanagan's getting drunk right now. I just lost my parents. And I ran out. I dropped the papers. I ran out back of CVS and right behind the pond where I used to play hockey as a kid. And I just started crying. And it was like, because I realized that you had told me that if I work the steps, if I do this program, I'll build an archway through which I will walk a free man. And it was at that moment that I realized I don't ever, ever have to drink again. And it was just, I just couldn't help it. I had to cry. I hadn't cried since the, you know, ball went through Buckner's legs in the 86 World Series. But no, seriously, I just couldn't, and I realized, you know, this is something special. I've been given a gift. I don't know why. Why me? You know, and then they say, why not me? Well, yeah, there are a myriad of reasons why not me. But I don't know. I was, you know, what it's like today is I'm still filled with that joy. I still have that happiness. I have gone from anger and rage down to grouchy after 4 o'clock. I still got to work on that. I have a lot I still have to work on. I'll never be perfect, I have hope today. If I keep doing what I'm doing, if I keep doing what I was doing the first week when I was sober, when I first met Weyers, I just willing to go to any lengths, I can stay sober. I'm not different. Just because I'm dressed up doesn't mean I'm just another bozo on the bus. Trust me, I just did this out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know, I am no authority on staying sober. All I know is that if I do what you tell me to do, I can do it, and I can have a wonderful life. Today I'm not afraid. Today I'm not, you know, I used to be afraid of everything. I would jump at, oh my God. I remember the first time I was asked to read, I think it was the 12 steps when they say anonymity, and I got the anonymity wrong, and I screwed up, and I went home. I just dropped the reading, and I went home. I said, I'm never going back to that easy 1, 2, 3 again, ever. And Wes just called me. He couldn't stop laughing. But once he caught up, he goes, you know what, Bubba? I'll see you tomorrow night. I said, no, you won't. He goes, oh, yes, I will. And sure enough, I was there. And anyway, I don't know. It was just a scary time. But today, I feel, and I remember Daryl, my grand sponsor at the time, saying when he picked up his 6-year chip, he said, I feel comfortable in my skin today. I'm thinking, I'll never, ever feel comfortable in my skin. And today I do. Today I really do. I met a girl. There was a girl in my home group that asked me over for Easter dinner back in 2012. And she goes, you've got to meet my sponsor. And I thought she wanted to, you know, date me, and she didn't. But I met her sponsor. And her sponsor, you know, just... You know, she's my wife today, and she'll be your speaker next week. And advertisement. And I don't know how that happened. she wanted to date me, and I'm thinking, I thought she had time in the program. I really thought she was working with a sponsor. What? She doesn't go to meetings or something? She goes, no, she wants to date you, and she goes to a lot of meetings. I said, well, what's wrong? You know, and I really did. So I have to work on self-esteem issues too, I guess. But we got married last year. We moved to Cobb County, when we moved over there, I had to leave my home group that I was used to for 15 years. And I had Weiss had moved down to South Georgia. He lives in South Georgia. But I had gotten another sponsor named Mike, and I had to leave him too. And I had to start all over and get a new home group and a new, and it was different. It was scary. But I felt confident enough because I knew this worked, and I have a higher power that I knew was going to take care of me. He wants me to succeed. You know, he's given me this gift, and there's got to be a reason for it. So I will leave you with this. If you're new, we have a solution. If you're struggling and you don't know how to stop drinking, we can help you with that. It helped me. I didn't think, I thought I was beyond help because I wasn't sure if I wanted this and I wasn't sure if I didn't. So unsure. It said, one of the first things I heard was, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And so I said, what have I got to lose? I'll stop following your path. By the grace of God, I'm sober today. And, you know, I really didn't think I would get 16 years. I mean, I didn't think I'd last, 16 days, never mind that. And time isn't a big thing. The fact is that I'm not drinking today. Today is just, it's just another day to look forward to. I never look forward to any day. I look forward to getting into the bottle so I could forget about it all. And today I'm living. Today it's just a wonderful day to be alive. So thank all y'all for listening. Thank you.